is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
I think from the outside looking on in, everybody sees, okay, they stay at the Ritz-Carlton, they fly on this private plane, they've got food, great food for them everywhere, and they go to NBA games. It's a luxurious life. But what I think a lot of people are missing is that, I mean, you're away from your family constantly. And granted, scouts travel too. It's just the scheduling's a lot more flexible. And, I mean, you know, if you're following box scores, I mean, there's – with each game, there's a flight, there's a shoot-around, there's video prep work. And, I mean, that's your day in, day out throughout the entire season. And it's just – it's very demanding.
Matt Babcock is the owner and founder of Babcock Hoops. Matt also serves as an NBA draft analyst and is a key contributor to Babcock Hoops' written content. Before launching Babcock Hoops, Matt was a certified NBPA and FIBA agent and accumulated 11 years of experience in the sports management industry, working for a number of different agencies, including his own, Babcock Sports. Through his experience as an agent, he was exposed to the inner workings of basketball, providing him an array of knowledge about the business behind the game. Prior to the 2018 NBA draft, Matt served as a contributor for Sports Illustrated and The Crossover. He provided a series of stories outlining the protocols pertaining to the NBA draft process from the perspective of an NBA agent and the players they represent. Aside from Matt's experience as an agent and media member, he also brings firsthand experience as a former basketball player and coach. He was a standout player at George Walton High School in Marietta, Georgia, and went on to be a member of the basketball teams at Gulf Coast State College in Panama City, Florida, and the University of Arizona. He spent one season as an assistant coach for Virtus Bologna, a professional basketball team in Bologna, Italy. Along with Matt's professional experience, he also grew up in a basketball family. He learned the game from his father, Dave Babcock, director of player personnel for the Milwaukee Bucks, and his two uncles, Pete and Rob Babcock, both of whom are former NBA general managers. His two cousins, Chris and Nate Babcock, also hold positions within the Philadelphia 76ers and Atlanta Hawks organizations, respectively. Check out our website, hoopheadspod.com, where you can listen to every episode we've ever recorded, subscribe to our Hoopheads Pod newsletter, and learn about our show. After you've checked out the site, don't forget to leave that 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Word of mouth is the best way for our show to grow a larger audience, so please tell a friend or coaching colleague to give the Hoopheads Pod a listen. Get ready to learn from an experienced basketball mind as we talk with Matt Babcock from Babcock Hoops. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome Matt Babcock from Babcock Hoops. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on, dig into your basketball background, be able to talk a little bit of NBA and NBA draft with you. Let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid and talk to us a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
Well, I really didn't have much of a choice. I was born into a basketball family. My dad
my two uncles have all worked in basketball my entire life. My oldest uncle Pete got in the NBA in the late 70s. And then my dad was a college coach until I was, I think, 13, 14 years old. And he's been in the NBA for 20 years now. So, yeah, kind of, you know, born with the basketball in my hand.
So how did your dad get into the NBA? What was his break into it? How did he get involved?
Sure. Well, you know, like I said, my Uncle Pete, you know, he started doing some volunteer scouting, I think for the New Orleans Jazz in the late 70s, and kind of grinded it out for a few years and got his first break being an assistant coach for the San Diego Clippers. And his career just kind of took off. I mean, he ended up being the general manager of the Denver Nuggets in the mid and late 80s, and then a longtime general manager of the Atlanta Hawks. And so he's the one that sort of paved the way for all of us, including my dad. And so my dad bounced around being a college coach, assistant coach of some big universities, and head coach a couple JUCOs. And then he got a scouting job with the New Jersey Nets. John Calipari had hired him to be a regional scout. We lived in Phoenix, Arizona at the time. And he did that for just 1 year, and he got hired by the Milwaukee Bucks. And he's sort of just moved up the ladder within that organization. It's been there, I think he's on his like 23rd year. you know, sort of, you know, unheard of for a guy that the stick that long. But yeah, no, that's sort of how he got in. But yeah, credit to my Uncle Pete, really. He sort of paved the way for all of us.
So when you were younger, did you guys end up moving around a lot as your dad was changing jobs?
Yeah, we did. You know, he typical college coach type stuff. You know, he bounced around every few years, sort of thing, just kind of moving up. You know, we moved quite a bit, but we were always in California and Arizona until we moved to Milwaukee, which was a little bit of a culture shock for me. But yeah, no, we did move quite a bit.
And so when you're moving around and you're getting into the game of basketball, what do you remember about your upbringing in the game, and what made you really want to be a basketball player, other than the fact that, you know, your dad was involved and your uncle was involved? What was it about the game itself that really attracted you to it and made you want to be a player and eventually have it as your life's work?
Sure. You know, I never even really remember like having a thought of like if basketball was going to be my life or not. It was just in my blood. It had been like that from day one. I mean, it was always the number one priority in my life. You know, my mom would say, you know, including school, which was always a problem. I idolized my dad growing up, you know, especially when he was a coach, you know, going to his practice, traveling with the team. It's just, you know, I'd always thought I was going to be a coach. It was always basketball. And so I really don't have a good answer for you, because it's just, you know, it's always been a part of, you know, pretty much the main part of my identity.
So if you think about the basketball system as it is today with AAU and the way that whole thing has gone with youth basketball, how would you characterize the way you came up in the game? Like, did you come through and play a lot of AAU basketball? Were you playing more pick up basketball? Well, how would you characterize your development as a player?
Well, I mean, stereotypical coach's son. I did a lot of work by myself. I mean, I grew up on, you know, pistol Pete ball handling drills, you know, just getting a lot of shots. So, I mean, I was very skilled as a player, you know, early on, just because, you know, I was properly coached.
Right.
And, you know, but I did go through the AAU system. I started playing AAU when I was in eighth grade. Played for a team, the Arizona Stars, and then when we moved to Wisconsin, I played for a few different teams, but the main team I played for was Friends of Hoop, which was George Karl's team. So I played with George's son Kobe, and then Ernie Grunfeld was the GM of the Bucks at the time, and his son Dan was on our team too. So we sort of had a Bucks family AAU team.
Gotcha. And so what was your favorite experience from playing AAU basketball?
You know, I think the summer summer after our junior year, which is like the big recruiting year for high school kids, you know, traveling around, going all to the big tournaments, and, you know, playing against some of the top guys that, you know, ended up being like NBA superstars. I mean, you know, played against LeBron James, you know, a number of guys. That was a fun experience, just kind of going through the circuit and just sort of like all of the hype and attention everybody gets during that time.
Did you sort of, because of your dad's background and just the way you came up in the game, did you kind of take it for granted as you were coming up that you'd get an opportunity to play college basketball? Or was that something that you kind of felt like, hey, I got to grind towards this? Or what was your mentality at that time?
Well, you know, it's, I think growing up in a basketball family, everybody, you know, kind of looks at all the privileges. You know, on the flip side of that, there's a lot of pressure that's put on you too. I mean, everybody expects you to be good, including myself. I put a lot of pressure on myself as a player, and you know, I kind of had, you know, I still do have big shoes to fill with my whole family working and having success in basketball. Yeah, so I never took it for granted that it was just going to be handed to me. You know, just because I really set the bar high for myself, which is, you know, at times probably a little bit unfair.
I believe that. So as you were going through your high school career, at what point did it become a reality that, hey, I'm going to have an opportunity maybe to play this game beyond high school? And then talk a little bit about what the recruiting process was like for you.
Sure. Well, I was an early bloomer, so I'm about 6'1", 6'2" now, but I was the same height as a freshman in high school. And, you know, like I mentioned, I was a little ahead of the game as far as my skill set, just because I was a, you know, coach's son. You know, so I led my team in scoring on varsity all 4 years. So the expectations started then. I mean, I had some big games as a freshman and expected to play in college. And you know, I for myself personally, I thought sky was the limit. I didn't grow anymore, and you know, didn't you know, get significantly better just because my skill set was already pretty high.
How tall is your dad?
Oh, my dad's 6'5". You know,
you thought you had a bigger runway, huh?
Yeah, no, exactly. And so I thought I was going to be like a 6'5", 6'6" combo guard, and which is a you know, big difference than being a 6'1", you know, shooting guard.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So as you go through and schools start coming in and talking to you and recruiting you, just tell us a little bit about what that was like for you, maybe just some interesting conversations or experiences you had with coaches that were coming in and talking to you, because obviously with your family name and people kind of know that coming in, whether or not that had some kind of impact on just the interaction that you had with coaches or not.
Yeah. You know, my recruiting process during high school was a little different. You know, I transferred my senior year of high school, and it kind of threw off my recruiting a bit, which is a whole nother story we'll get to another time maybe. And so I'd gotten some good offers from D1 schools. And like I mentioned before, I set the bar high. I expected a lot from, you know, of myself and for myself, and I wanted more. So I ended up going to a JUCO in Florida. At the time, prep schools weren't as big a deal. I mean, I talked to Maine Central Institute, which is a prep school in, you know, obscure place in Maine, and they had started getting that going. Like DeMar Johnson had just played there, and I thought about doing that. I don't know. I thought it'd be tough to go to such an isolated place, but I knew I needed an extra year to get stronger and, you know, kind of boost up my stock. So I ended up going to a junior college in Panama City, Florida, for a year, and unfortunately got hurt, and you know that. Again, screwed up my recruitment pretty good, and ultimately ended up walking on as a sort of a preferred walk-on at Arizona.
So what was that experience like as a walk-on? How, because I think there's a lot of, you know, people out there, there's maybe misconceptions is the wrong way to say it, but I don't think people have a really good understanding of what the life of a walk-on at the Division I level, especially the high Division I level, is. So just talk to us a little bit about what your experience was like, maybe just from the first day you kind of set foot into conditioning or the first team meeting, and how the guys accepted you and how the coaching staff was with you, and just talk a little bit about what that experience was like.
Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, I was in, you know, a pretty unique situation for being a walk-on, since I was, you know, a Division I caliber player. Granted, I wasn't good enough to be recruited to Arizona just, you know, by itself. But I mean, I was, you know, I was taken serious. I think I was taken seriously by all the other players. And,
right.
I mean, I could play. I could hold my own, and, you know, kind of grew up, you know, going through the same stuff they did. I mean, I played ABCD camp. Yeah, I stepped in, you know, ready to go, and, you know, wanting to play. But I mean, really, after my injury in Florida, you know, going to a big school like that, you know, it was more about the experience. I knew I was going to work in basketball. That'd be a great opportunity to kind of gain some experience, meet some interesting people, kind of get a grip of, you know, that level of basketball, and, you know, take that to my, you know, whatever my next step was going to be, working in basketball.
Did you have a thought before you decided to go to Arizona? Did you have a thought of going to
maybe a mid-major D1 with the idea that, hey, I'm going to be able to get out on the floor and get some more playing time and get an opportunity to really get out on the court versus maybe that opportunity might have been more limited at Arizona. What was the thought process as far as choosing to go and be a walk-on at Arizona versus going somewhere where maybe you could have got more playing time and minutes out on the floor?
Sure, and I think if I hadn't gotten hurt, I probably would have done that. I got hurt 2 years in a row. I had big issues with my knee, and it was kind of one of these things where it's just like I didn't think my body was going to hold up anyway.
Right.
But yeah, no, we went back and forth on it. And, you know, pretty much, you know, transfer my senior year and then having 2 years of being hurt, it was a little bit of me throwing in the white towel, just, you know, looking to kind of move on to working in basketball. But yeah, no, you know, looking back on it, I mean, I do regret not having the chance to play a whole lot. You know, so I mean, it definitely would have been something that, I mean, maybe I would have done things a little bit differently as far as, you know, taking care of my body so I could have avoided the injury, so I could have gone and played it like a mid-major.
What's your best Coach Olson story?
Oh, boy. I don't really have one off the top of my head. It just, you know, I mean, when I was there, so I played on his team of the last full season he coached. And, you know, just, I mean, day in, day out, he's just a classy guy that ran a good program. I mean, the guy was a living legend at the time. I think he was 72 years old when he was our coach that year. And, you know, our team went to the Elite Eight, and it was just a, you know, neat experience to be able to be around, you know, such a great coach.
So when you get done there and you graduate, and you know you want to be in the game, and I know you had mentioned earlier that you thought coaching was going to be the direction that you wanted to go. So just talk a little bit about the decision-making process in terms of where you decided to go with your career once you got done playing, and then we'll kind of walk through the genesis of, you know, getting you to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. I at that point, I thought I was going to be a coach. You know, I'd already started like kind of working out guys, doing some player development stuff, and you know, kind of activated our network, just kind of throw my name out there and see what opportunities would be there. And I was offered a summer internship with Wasserman Media Group, which at the time was the biggest sports agency in sports. I had no intention of being an agent or, you know, working on the business side of basketball. So my job as an intern kind of evolved where with Dave Yeager, who was a G League coach at the time. He and I ran all of their pre-draft workouts, and they had like a loaded class. It was so we did all the workouts for like 2-3 months with Brandon Roy, JJ Redick, Sheldon Williams, Jordan Farmar, Joel Freeland. I mean, I think they had like 6 first round picks or something like that. And then I did do some stuff in the office for them too. And that was like my introduction to the agency world. I still, when I finished that job up, I still didn't think I was going to be an agent. I actually took a job as an assistant coach with a professional team in Italy and went there. And then I was offered a job by another big agency. And that's kind of when I got into the agent world. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I did it for 11 years.
So if you think about that decision-making process and just the fact, again, you kind of have to take an opportunity when it comes, as you got into, you know, the agency side of it, what were some of the things that you liked about being an agent that kept you in it for that long?
You know, early on, it was fun sort of, you know, tapping into to the network that, you know, I sort of inherited from my family and kind of just growing up and everything. I knew everybody already. And so, I mean, you know, being able to add value to, you know, legitimate companies at such a young age, it was exciting. You know, get your blood going a little bit, you know, helping broker some stuff. And so, I mean, early on, just like the excitement of dealing with some high, you know, high level players and going to games, and, you know, it was fun. And then I think, you know, sort of what had happened as I got older and my responsibilities increased as an agent and started having my own clients, you know, the negatives started to become, you know, more and more apparent. I mean, obviously it's been well documented, all the sleazy stuff in that side of the business. And it's just, God, I feel like every year it was just getting a little bit worse. And it just, long story short, just business kind of wore me out. And I just, you know, made a decision just to get out and get back a little closer to my roots and do something a little bit more directly basketball related.
Did you find it difficult to be, I don't know what the right way to say it is, but did you find it difficult to run a clean business, for lack of a better term, you know, competing out there for clients and just that kind of thing? Was that one of the things that turned you off to it, or what?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, with in my family within basketball circles is well known for being very ethical and professional. And so, I mean, it's, you know, coming from a family like that, you know, there's, you know, I had wanted to, you know, operate with the principles that I was taught, but also I was representing my whole family. And so, I mean, I couldn't go around, you know, being this cutthroat guy and burning bridges and doing all this illegal business, you know, just for my family's sake, if anything else. And, you know, and if it's sort of one of those businesses, if you're not willing to get your hands dirty, you're going to limit how much business you're going to generate. Cause it's just, you know, somebody had said at one point, you know, an agent is only as good as his client list. And so, you know, that one thing that led me to getting out is that, you know, I had success as an agent, but my client list, I didn't feel like reflected how much I had developed as an agent. You know, it's really right. A matter of like, who can you sign?
And for sure.
If I'm not willing to, you know, drop off a bag of money, you know, it's going to limit it on how profile, you know, high profile guys I'm going to get.
Yeah, for sure. And that makes it very, very tough when you're trying to, when you're trying to run an ethical business in a place that isn't always ethical. That makes it very, very challenging. At any point during that time while you were while you were an agent, or maybe even after, immediately after, when you started looking around and saying, hey, maybe I want to do something else, was there ever any thought to jumping back into coaching and thinking that, hey, maybe I'll get back into the coaching space as opposed to going the direction that you ended up going?
No, you know, it's, you know, my two cousins, they're coaches in the NBA. And the biggest thing with coaching is just the regimented schedule day in, day out, and the brutal travel. It didn't appeal. The lifestyle didn't appeal to me that much. That's pretty much why I got out initially. And then it's just, you know, with my dad having been in the NBA on the front office side for so long, I really got an inner look on how that operates. And then being, you know, an agent for so long, you know, I really kind of just, you know, naturally became more interested on the business side of an NBA front office. And so that's sort of what led me to the scouting, and I'm doing some consulting stuff too. But never really considered getting back into coaching.
So give people an idea of the life of an NBA coach and just the amount of time that gets put into it, whether you're, you know, whether you're the video guy or you're a player development guy or, you know, you're the head coach. I don't know that everybody has an understanding. You know, you see games on TV and people, you know, see the glamour and see the money, but I don't think they necessarily understand the grind. Can you talk a little bit about maybe what that grind is like as an NBA coach from someone who's kind of been on the inside?
Sure. You know, and it's funny, my two cousins, they've both stopped through Denver on their West Coast swings the last week. One's with Philly and one's with Atlanta. I went to the Hawks Nuggets game last night, and you know, had dinner with their team after and everything. And you know, it's you know, I think from the outside looking on in, everybody sees, okay, they stay at the Ritz-Carlton, they fly on this private plane, they've got great food for them everywhere, and they go to NBA games. It's a luxurious life. But what I think a lot of people are missing is that, I mean, you're away from your family constantly. And granted, scouts travel too. It's just the scheduling's a lot more flexible. And I mean, you know, if you're following box scores, I mean, there's with each game, there's a flight, there's a shoot around, there's video prep work. And I mean, that's your day in, day out throughout the entire season. And it's just, it's very demanding.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that we've talked to a lot of high school coaches, a lot of college coaches. And it's one of those things that I think people who aren't in the coaching profession don't always understand. And I guess we look at it here from maybe a parent perspective of the parent of a high school player and not understanding how much time a high school coach puts in, and a college parent the same way. And I think the average NBA fan doesn't necessarily understand that grind that an NBA coach goes through. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges facing the coaching profession is just how do you maintain that work-life balance that enables you to do a great job. And we all know that putting in the time is what ultimately makes you successful. I think that, you know, you compare maybe to when you were in high school or when I was in high school, I think the baseline expectation for what a high school coach is supposed to do compared to what a high school coach is supposed to do today, I think the demands on a coach's time today are even more than they've ever been. And I think it makes it very, very difficult for somebody who has a family and wants to have a work-life balance to make that happen. I think it's just a challenge to me after talking to, you know, high school and college coaches. I think that's one of the biggest things that they're struggling with all the time is how do I balance my ambition as a coach, my desire to build the type of program that I want to build versus, you know, I want to be there for my family and still be, you know, still stay married and still be a good father or a good mother to my children.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, another thing with that too is, I mean, for head coaches at any level, the amount of stress and, you know, being able to manage the stress and not have it affect your family life, it's a challenging part of sports too, which I think a lot of people lose sight of.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. I think it's, you know, people see that glamour, they see the big contracts and they forget about the guy who's the video coordinator, the graduate assistant or the assistant high school coach and that are putting in just as much time and are, you know, if you look at a high school coach's pay, they're making like 10 cents an hour for the amount of time that they're putting in. So, so obviously you made a choice there not to go into coaching. And I think there's probably some very good reasons why you didn't. So let's talk a little bit about what you decided to do instead and talk about how Babcock Hoops got started, what you were thinking when you got it going, and then we'll kind of dive into where you think it's headed in the future.
Yeah, sure. So what had happened, and I thought about getting out of the agency business for a couple of years and just push came to shove, and I just, you know, dissolved the company. You know, I had two separate entities. I had an international agency and an American-based agency. It took me a little bit of time to kind of get in that you know, broken apart properly. And then I wasn't really exactly sure what I was going to do next. I mean, I'd talked to some NBA teams about possibly taking a job with them. But what I did instead was I started scouting for Marty Blake and Associates. It was a scouting service that was put together by the NBA, I think in the early 80s or sometime. And so I started just scouting for them, doing college games, you know, just you know, covering the NBA draft. And then while I was doing that, I got approached by Sports Illustrated to write a series of stories, pretty much like an agent's perspective of the pre-draft process. So, you know, all of a sudden I found myself doing, you know, draft coverage, scouting, and then doing some writing, and I enjoyed it. And so in the, you know, after that draft and summer league and everything, I kind of just went back to the drawing board and decided to kind of create my own entity to do these different things all under my own umbrella. And so, you know, I did that and sort of, you know, as I was putting together that idea, I realized, you know, I really could create a platform for NBA experienced scouts that were in between jobs for whatever reasons, give them sort of a place that they can go and operate while they're looking for their next job. So we put together a staff of all former NBA scouts and just, you know, cover the draft and, you know, really just try to create a different outlet, you know, for people that want draft coverage, want to hear some stuff about, you know, the inside, you know, basketball stories and whatnot, and really just having a lot of fun doing it. And it's really kind of come along pretty nicely.
So when you start looking at a draft prospect, what are some of the key things that you look for that you think make a difference in ultimately what the player's level of success is going to be? And, you know, there's clearly some physical tools that guys have to have, and, you know, there's basketball skills that guys have to have, but is there anything that you've kind of tapped into and you're looking at a guy's workout or you're looking at his film and you're trying to figure out, well, what are the intangibles that drive this guy? Is there anything that you see that you can pick out? And obviously it's a very inexact science, but anything that stands out to you in that realm that maybe makes it more likely that a guy's going to have success?
Yeah, you know, when you're evaluating players, I mean, there's a million different variables. And I mean, I really don't think it's one thing or another. It's just a balance of it all, you know. So I mean, there, you know, we're looking at one guy and, you know, maybe he's lacking intelligence, but he's got these, you know, perfect, you know, physical tools and, you know, whatever the equation is, it's all about the sum of the equation. What, you know, how do the variables all add up? So, I mean, yeah, we look at, you know, positional size, obviously athleticism and just basic, you know, skill set. But then we also break down, you know, background, character traits, brain types. I mean, all that stuff is taken into consideration. And again, it's just, it needs to be a balance that ends up, you know, at the end of the day, you're like, all right, this guy is good because of X, Y, and Z.
As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game.
So how much has the evaluation process changed in the time that you've been doing it? And then go back to, and let's just say, okay, let's go back 30 years ago when obviously you weren't analyzing draft prospects, but think about what that process was like in terms of how much do you guys look at the, quote, new school analytics versus the old school eye test and just your experience?
Yeah, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. I mean, obviously, you know, the game has changed and evolved quite a bit. I mean, I think that for me, you know, I personally have, I guess I haven't been doing that this all that long, but my family has. So I've kind of had the, you know, inside look. I think since my dad started doing this, I mean, the biggest change is that, you know, the style of play. And so, I mean, you're looking at certain players and like, do they fit into today's game? And I mean, you know, a big bodied five, you got to kind of evaluate him differently than you did, you know, 15 years ago. Same thing for, you know, a power forward that can't shoot the ball from outside. I mean, most of these offenses in the NBA, you know, they're all spread offenses. And, you know, if you're not able to stretch it, you better be pretty dang good at everything else.
Yeah, no question about that. I think there's two interesting things that I think are related to what you said. One is you think about back 20, 30 years ago and a big knock on a guy was, oh, this guy's a tweener. And now if the guy has skill, people want tweeners that can go slide between positions and, you know, guard multiple positions. And I think that's something that definitely has changed. And then you mentioned about the big centers. And we actually did a show now about, I don't know, it was probably 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago, Jason, yeah, I can't remember, something like that, where we did our all-time, you know, all-time top three NBA team, or, you know, and, you know, the top 15 players, we broke them into a first team, second team, third team. And the most difficult position to do was center, because there was just so many guys. If you were going to take one center for each of those top three teams, it became very, very difficult to parse out who you're going to put on each of those teams. Right. You look at the game today, and unless the rules change, I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't think we're ever going to see a center get anywhere near, you know, cracking that quote proverbial top 15 player of all time. Again, unless the rules somehow change that brings the big player that's down on the post back into the game.
Well, I mean, I still think there's a place for big guys. It's just that, you know, it's, you know, the big brute five with slow feet, like that's where things have changed. I mean, but I mean, like Olajuwon in today's game would be incredible. I mean, that guy was so athletic and agile. I mean, he wouldn't be vulnerable at all in a high pick and roll because he can move his feet, he can defend everybody. And so it just kind of changes which big guys are effective. But I still think there's a lot of value with a guy that, I mean, James Wiseman right now at Memphis, I have him as my clear-cut number one pick this year.
So what do you, let's jump right in there. Obviously he's involved in a little bit of controversy, and it's interesting to see, you know, what's going to happen. I guess we could talk a little bit about that, but first let's just talk about him as a prospect and what you like about him, what you think he's going to bring to the table in the NBA.
Well, I mean, when you first see him, I mean, it just his physical tools. I mean, he's 7'1". He's got, I think, a 7'5" or 7'6" wingspan. He's really filling out nicely. He's becoming a really strong guy. But then he moves really well. And I wouldn't say he's like crazy athletic, but he's very coordinated, and he's, you know, can move his feet. And then his, you know, skill wise, he's got good hands. He's got a good skill level. He's able to shoot from outside. terrific timing, shot blocking, rebounding. I mean, he's really, there's just not a whole lot wrong with him. It, I'm a really big fan of Wiseman. I mean, if I'm going to nitpick, I do think he's lacking a little bit of the alpha dog trait. I mean, I wouldn't characterize him as like a soft guy by any means, but he's not a very vocal, you know, loud, you know, outgoing star type personality that you usually see. So I don't know how big of an issue that is yet, but like that's one thing that I'm sort of tracking with him, is just sort of following his personality and his development and maturity there.
As the season plays out, what's your feeling on, is he going to be able to remain eligible for the rest of the season? You think he plays out the entire season, or do you think at some point that it gets cut off? It seems like, because Memphis is kind of thumbing their nose at the NCAA, that, you know, if they can keep it hung up in the courts for long enough, that, you know, at least Wiseman will get to play the whole year, and then Memphis will have to deal with the repercussions afterward, is kind of how it seems right now.
Right. I don't know. I wish I had a good answer for you. It's a pretty crazy situation. I hope he keeps playing. I mean, I like watching him, and I think Memphis's team is so much talent. I mean, I was surprised to see they lost to Oregon the other night, but I mean, I think if their freshmen play all year and they all, you know, get a little bit more comfortable, I think they could be a real threat.
I think the big thing is a lot of people are confused about the whole Wiseman thing because of the tweet error that was put out, that like Hardaway had paid in 2008, but it was actually 2018, but there was a typo. And I just remember seeing a lot of people like, well, that was 11 years ago. Why does it matter? Well, it was actually last year, right?
Right. Not exactly. I mean, as far as the legal part of it, you know, I don't know. I mean, generally with these big programs, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire in regards to the recruiting. So I mean, if the NCAA is digging, they're probably going to find more stuff. So I mean, that's where I think they're kind of, I think Memphis, and this is not any kind of insider information, it's just me, you know, again, just kind of looking from the outside on in. I mean, if they're going to go do a formal investigation, I mean, they had the number one recruiting class in the country. I mean, I don't know. I would imagine there's probably some other issues that are going to pop up. So they're, you know, to me, it seems like their program is playing with fire here a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and you know, bringing Penny in, and obviously he's got a history there, and you know, had a great NBA career that was cut short by injury, and you know, now he comes in and all of a sudden, boom, he's, you know, the number one recruiting class, and you know, Memphis obviously hasn't been near the top of that for, you know, for a number of years, and Penny's a big name, and you know, so to some degree you can understand it. But I think, you know, you're right, and it goes back to, I guess, a little bit of the conversation we had earlier about, you know, being an agent and try to run a clean program. I think there's probably something to be said for that at the highest levels of college basketball as well, that if you're trying to run a clean and ethical program, I got to believe that day in and day out, you're facing some challenges, because there are people that are out there that, you know, again, we've seen through the various investigations, there are people that are out there that are bending the rules, and whether those rules are fair or not, or another, you know, that's a whole other topic for, you know, another day in terms of the NCAA and some of the things that that they put out there. But it's got to be, you know, it's got to be a challenge if you're a high level Division I coach in college basketball and you're trying to run a clean program. Those other prospects that we have coming up in this year's draft, and then maybe we can jump back to last year's draft, because I know Jason and I are a little bit more well versed in the guys that have made it to the NBA now, as opposed to the college guys.
And I want to hear what you have to say about Ball.
Yeah, what's your take on LaMelo?
Yeah, you know, I've been somewhat slow to warm with LaMelo. You know, this last spring, I was invited to go to the Big Baller All American game in Las Vegas. I was a little hesitant. Truth be told, but
didn't want to get associated.
Yeah, and I went, and you know, spent 2 days with them. Went to practice, talked to LeVar, talked to LaMelo, and then covered the game. They, you know, put me right on the floor. So I mean, I got a, you know, pretty, you know, up close and personal look, you know, with him. You know, he started growing me a little bit. I'd kind of, you know, I said it went from like slow to warm. You know, I just seen all the stuff, you know, with him early on. He just seemed like a pretty immature entitled kid, and he's really come around. I mean, for one, he's grown, his body's filling out a little bit, and he's playing his butt off in Australia. I mean, we've been doing a lot of video work on him, and Yeah, I mean, I've got him as the second pick in the draft, which, you know, it's funny. I got a message from Jermaine Jackson, former NBA player, that's his coach, like his workout coach. And
right.
I had told Jermaine in Vegas, he was talking about, you know, LaMelo's got a chance to be the number one pick, and I just told him he's crazy and there's no chance. And he had just messaged me a few days ago. He's like, I think about that conversation all the time when I'm working with LaMelo every day, and like, we talk about it. So they're throwing it in my face that he's
got to have something that drives you, right?
Yeah, everybody, sure.
Everybody needs a chip on their shoulder.
Right, yeah, so I guess I'm happy to help, right?
That's it. You can have a hand in making him the number one pick. Right. So how much does – when you look at him, how much does – LeVar and sort of what Lonzo has done in his career to this point, which I guess you'd have to say he's been, I don't know, disappointing maybe is not the right word, because I don't think he's been super disappointing, but he certainly hasn't
lived up
to what people thought potentially he could be. And obviously he's still young and there's still time for him to turn it around. But how much, when you're looking at LaMelo, are the concerns with Lonzo and LeVar a part of how you might evaluate him as an NBA team or as a, you know, as a scout?
Well, I mean, a couple of thoughts here. One, I think LeVar sort of being put in his place here is a good thing for LaMelo. I mean, I don't think there's going to be nearly as many distractions as there was with Lonzo. So I don't see that being a big holdup. I definitely think teams will be doing their homework, you know, as far as, you know, how things will go and, you know, who's going to be with him, you know, in that city next year and all those kinds of things. But I don't see that being a big holdup. With Lonzo, you know, I think Lonzo's really good. I think the expectations were set by his dad. And I think it was so poorly managed, setting this kid up for failure. Like, he's a good player. So I really don't see there being a whole lot of overwhelming, you know, negative stuff that's going to hurt, you know, LaMelo's stock. It's just early in the year. I mean, just, you know, teams and myself, we need to watch him some more. And I like to see him put together, you know, a full campaign of doing what he's doing now. And I think he'll be in that, you know, top five mix.
So what you're saying is you wouldn't hire LeVar to be a PR person?
I don't think I would.
So let me ask you this about just going back to Lonzo for a second. Like, I look at Lonzo, and to me, he seems like a guy who would be a great fit on a really good team, because he's not a guy who, even though he's a distributor, he doesn't need to have the ball in his hands all the time. He's one of those passers that when you watch him pass, anybody who knows basketball and you watch a guy who really knows how to pass the ball, it's just, he already knows where the ball's going. It gets to him and he already knows where it's going. He makes the easy pass. Like, your casual fan loves the fancy pass. What real basketball people love is the guy who makes the next simple pass, makes the easy pass, makes the pass to the guy who's open. And then there are obviously some guys who see things, whether you're talking about LeBron or Doncic now, that see things that other guys just don't see. But I think Lonzo, if you put him on a really good team, I think his passing would shine. He's already a really good defender. He's a good rebounder for his size. And, you know, I'll just be curious if he keeps working and, you know, he can develop his shot. I think he still has a chance to be, as you said, a really good player.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, I think he's good now. I'm really, as everybody is, I'm sure, to see him with Zion. And I mean, just, you know, and like you said, his feel for the game is just uncanny. I mean, his ability to deliver passes and his timing on his decision making is just really, really something special. I mean, obviously his outside shooting is getting better. It's still a work in progress, right? And I think, you know, once he's able to get to that, to a certain point, that'll open up everything for him quite a bit. But I still really like him. I mean, I think the, you know, as I touched on before, I think the expectations were set too high for him. But I mean, if you really compare him, you know, to other guys that have been in recent drafts, he's a good player, you know? So, I mean, I wouldn't consider him a bust or anything like that.
No, I don't think so either. I think he's just got to find, the right situation. And, you know, maybe when Zion comes back, that ends up being the right place. And obviously Ingram's taken a big leap ahead this year compared to, you know, to where he's been the last couple of years in LA. And that was good to see, because I think there was a lot of people that were, you know, that were really high on Ingram, and he kind of, you know, waded his way through the first 2 years and wasn't nearly as developed as people thought he was. And again, he was young and skinny and just you know, I think still trying to find his way. And so it's good to see him kind of coming around. And I think if you're New Orleans and you look at what you have in Ingram, and then you're going to throw Zion on top of that, you know, they've got, plus all the draft picks and everything that they have, you know, coming forward in the next few years. I think if you're a New Orleans Pelicans fan, you have a lot to look forward to if Zion can stay healthy.
Absolutely. And, you know, David Griffin's been a good family friend for a long time, and he's done such a great job. And, you know, his short time being GM there, obviously, you know, winning that first pick, I mean, helps expedite the whole process.
No doubt about that.
I'm happy with what they've got going on there. It's I'm excited to see all their young guys develop. And I think it's a really, really nice group of guys. I think they all complement each other pretty well. I mean, Brandon Ingram's still really starting to turn it on. And I've got high hopes for Jackson Hayes, too. I mean, I think he's, you know, a couple years down the road. But, I mean, got him and Zion together. I mean, really talk about complementing each other. And, I think future's bright for them.
What's your feel on Zion? I mean, going into it, you feel like, hey, this guy has a chance to be an all-time talent. This guy has a chance to be, you know, a perennial all-star. Where did you sit on his ultimate potential heading into last year's draft? Obviously, he was a consensus number one, but just looking at him long term, like, where did you see his career kind of heading if he maximized what he could do?
Yeah, you know, we had launched our first mock draft last fall before the season, and I had him as the clear-cut number one before this even started. And so then when he started playing, it just obviously upped it up a bunch for me. I mean, I think the guy, if he's able to stay healthy and you know, keep his weight at a controllable weight, I mean, I think he could be a perennial all-star. And you know, I mean, to put expectations any higher than that, I really wouldn't want to do that to any kid at this stage,
right.
No, I think he's big time. It's just you know, having such a unique body type. Yeah, there's some concerns of like how he's going to hold up because you just don't have a whole lot to compare him to. But yeah, if he's able to still healthy, he's just such a physical force.
So to go along with that, do you guys? I know there's some companies out there that are doing the biometric analysis of guys now with, you know, how they run and how they land and pressure points and, you know, which way their ankles are pronating and when they land and all that kind of stuff. So do you guys get into much of that, of looking at the long-term, I guess, injury prognosis for guys? Is that something that you incorporate into what you do, or maybe not as much yet, or where do you stand on that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have anything specifically in-house with that. I think for us, it's more of, you know, we work our network, speaking with people, gathering information. But yeah, no, it's definitely part of the whole deal. I mean, that's the one thing with NBA teams, when you get into the pre-draft process, the medicals are so huge. And you know, discussing, you know, biomechanics and just, you know, basic injury history. That's, you know, most of the time when a guy slips, it's usually because of injuries or, you know, something in his background or character has kind of come to light. You know, I don't think a guy going and hitting a bunch of shots in a pre-draft workout is going to move him, you know, move the needle for him too much. It's all the little details, really.
All right. So can you walk us through what it looks like if I'm an NBA prospect and I'm coming in and a team is considering drafting me, what does that process look like for me, for the team, from sort of start to finish? Or if they bring me in for a visit, what are some of the things that I'm going through as a prospect when a team brings me in to evaluate me ahead of the draft?
Sure. Well, and I think let's kind of take a look at it. You know, I guess sort of put my agent hat on to sort of walk you through the timetable of it all. So a kid will finish school, you know, last game of the year, and then he'll start meeting with agents, hire an agent. Then the agent will survey all of the teams to gather information of, hey, you know, I'm representing this guy. What do you think of the player? You analyze which picks he has, and now all of a sudden, you know, getting sort of like your basis of what his stock value is, you know, amongst all the teams. That's the starting point, and then you schedule his workouts and whatnot. So what will happen is most teams will really start the workout process after the combine. So you have a good month of like squeezing in, you know, 10 teams maybe. So a team will fly you out. Usually will take you to dinner. And it'll sort of be like a casual interview dinner, just getting to know each other sort of thing. You'll do, you know, a bunch of physical testing. You'll do medicals, and then just do an on court workout, and then be interviewed by their staff. I mean, a lot of teams are doing bringing a psychiatrist in,
you know, to interview the guy too. So, I mean, it's pretty intense, and they kind of take a, you know, comprehensive approach when they're with the kids.
So if you think about that on-court workout, how different in your experience is an agent and going through, and I'm assuming that you're sitting in and watching those workouts with your guys, how different are the our team's workouts? So in other words, is one team putting a guy through a complete grind and another team's just putting him out there for a half an hour? Is there a difference in terms of team philosophies, or is it pretty much everybody's kind of running the same basic type of workout, or is there a team or two that kind of stands out to you as maybe doing something unusual out there on the floor?
You know, I'd say generally speaking, the whole setup is pretty similar across the board. I mean, there are teams that are known for working guys harder. I mean, we used to get so ticked off when we'd send a guy to a team like Van Gundy when he was with Houston was really well known for killing the guys in the workout. And you know, obviously they wanted to do that to give them, you know, an advantage so the guy would not look as good at other workouts. He'd be tired, right, and you know, beat up and all that. And yeah, that stuff happens. I mean, every team is you know, has the flexibility of doing things how they wish. So I mean, you know, team by team, but it's generally pretty similar.
Got it. All right. Before we go to this year's draft, let's jump back, if you don't care, to last year's and just kind of look at the guys who are rookies. We talked a little bit about Zion. We're here in Cleveland. So what was your feelings on Darius Garland heading into the draft? And then just give us your thoughts on what you've seen so far during this season.
Yeah, you know, with Darius, you know, I'd seen him several times before he even, you know, stepped on campus, and so I mean, I had a pretty good foundation of him as a prospect, and luckily I was at I think it was their first game of the year at USC, and he was tremendous, and so I mean, I was high on him before he got hurt. You know, he's really good. I haven't had a chance to watch them this year. I've been so focused on college basketball
understood.
So far.
Yep, it,
I'm kind of getting lost in that a little bit. But, yeah, I like him. He's going to be good. I'm interested to see long-term if he and Sexton can coexist there. You know, they're both, you know, 6'2", 6'3", you know, pretty small backcourt. But he's a good player. I mean, he really shoots the ball well. But, he's also a good playmaker as well.
Yeah, we had that same question. I mean, it's one of the things that Jason and I talked about, you know, pre-draft was – you know, if you draft Garland and you already have Sexton and they're both, I think, similar players, you know, to some degree, I think Garland's probably a better shooter. Sexton maybe has a little bit more going to the basket, a little bit more physical. Neither one of them, I guess Sexton in college was more of a defender, and he's been better this year than he was last year, where he was just kind of a revolving door. But ultimately it felt like, and it still continues to feel like, if you're going to have both of those guys in your backcourt, you know, as your starters, that, man, it's gonna be tough to win at a high level when you have 2 6'2" guards in your backcourt in today's game. And our hope was that, you know, when you went through the draft and you looked at where the Cavs were picking, that the Cavs just looked at it and said, well, we're a long way from being able to contend, and we're sitting here with this pick, we're just gonna pick the best player available, regardless of whether or not, you know, he fit exactly with our style, because we got lots of time to figure it out before we have to start worrying about positional need anymore. It's not like Cavs aren't going to be competing for a title, although they've been a lot better this year than we certainly would have thought.
That's
so
it. That's all because of Beilein, though. I think I'm pretty sold on him being our coach. So
yeah,
Beilein, as you should be. No, yeah. Beilein's big time.
Yeah, he's been really, really good. I mean, I think, you know, you look at the track record of guys coming from college to the NBA, and it's, you know, it's probably not as bad as maybe the perception is, but it's certainly been, I guess, spotty is a good way to say it. And Beilein, it seems like right from day one that he's gotten guys to buy in, and you just watch what they're doing and you see the actions that they're going through. And it just feels like that he's, you know, again, he's sold these guys on the fact that, you know, that the things that he's bringing to the table are going to help them to be successful. And it's fun to watch. I don't think anybody thought that this Cavs team was going to be that fun to watch. And they've been, you know, they've been a lot of fun, and they've certainly been more competitive than I think anybody thought. So it's been a good season so far, and Garland's been, I would say he hasn't been spectacular. He's been solid, and I think that, you know, there's still going to be obviously room for him to grow. And I think Sexton has definitely taken a step up this year from where he was last year, both on both ends of the floor. So it'll be interesting to see how those two develop going forward.
The Head Start Basketball Holiday Camp for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 will be held on December 26th and 27th. Join us for two fun days of basketball fundamentals, contests, and small-sided games. You can find more information or get registered at headstartbasketball.com.
Other guy that we had some thoughts about that we kind of were debating back and forth was with DeAndre Hunter and Jarrett Culver. So can you talk a little bit about what you thought of those two guys heading into last year?
Yeah, no, we liked both guys. And it's funny, I just watched DeAndre Hunter live last night. He my big issue with him is that I thought he was an undersized four. Atlanta's playing him primarily as a three. And, man, he just looks like a totally different guy. He's doing stuff off the dribble. And it's funny, I think he just sort of got soaked up into that Virginia system, and it made him look differently than what he actually is. But I did like him. He's, you know, really solid guy. You know, he's got the, you know, great wingspan, really strong, defends everybody, and he can shoot from outside. And if he's able to, you know, as it's showing now, add more to his offensive arsenal, I think his upside could be a little higher than what I was thinking prior to the draft. And with Culver, I saw him a lot last year. And talk about just what a great year he had. And I thought Chris Beard used him perfectly. Good players, got good length, just a great overall game. I think the key for him is outside shooting. I still don't fully trust his outside shot. It's not broken, but if he could develop that, I think it will kind of open things up for him pretty good.
Yeah, that was the guy that I liked for the Cavs. I thought, you know, again, just looking at the fit next to Sexton, I thought he would be a guy that would fit in well with his size and just, you know, his all-around ability. And then Hunter, I agree with you 100% in that when I watched him, I kind of felt like, okay, he's going to be able to shoot. You know, he's going to be able to defend. I'm not sure that he has the kind of creativity and things that off the dribble and being able to create for others that I would want at the number four. You know, I'd want more out of my number four pick. And maybe he's going to, you know, maybe he's going to get there. Maybe that's something that he's going to develop, as you said, and maybe the system at Virginia was kind of holding them back and not giving them the opportunity to showcase those skills. So it'll be interesting to see how he develops, which again, with all these guys, you know, you have your ideas, your thoughts of what you think they're going to be when you head into the draft. And then over the course of their career, you know, guys do things, some guys improve, some guys don't. And eventually, you know, careers end up where they end up because of A, their talent, and then B, what, you know, what kind of work ethic and situation and all those things are so important. And I think that sometimes people forget that where you're drafted and the team that you play for, and probably even more importantly, the coach that you play for, has a big impact. I'm sure you saw that as an agent, that there were some places where you're like, man, I hope this guy gets drafted by team X, Y, or Z, and I hope he doesn't get drafted by, you know, these other teams. Did you find that when you were, you know, when you were representing players, that there were situations that you looked at and you could clearly say, ooh, this situation would be more favorable for my client, maybe this one wouldn't be a good match?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I still look at that. And, you know, it's funny, my cousin and I, you know, we had dinner last night, and we were talking about stuff similar to this, you know, sort of hypotheticals if we were ever, you know, general managers of a team, that kind of thing. And, you know, one like philosophical thing I look at is that, okay, if a team is drafting by best player available, it could end up being a disaster for the team and the player, because if he's not able to develop properly or find himself in a depth chart or into a role that he can have success, I mean, it could really change the course of his career. And so, I mean, you know, like you said, as an agent, yeah, we really, I mean, for a player that had, you know, high market value and a number of teams wanted him, yeah, we looked at their depth chart. We looked at the coaching style, yeah, because that could really make or break a kid's career.
Yeah, I think you probably, like, I look at, just as an example, I think of Draymond Green as being a guy who, you know, he came into a perfect situation where his skill set was one that fit perfectly with those other guys who were on the Warriors, where if he had gone somewhere where he might have been on a worse team or he was expected to be the first or second best player on the team, I don't think his career would have developed in the same way, because that wasn't his skill set, and he ended up falling into a perfect situation and became a guy who was, you know, arguably one of their most important players, but not necessarily a guy who you'd want to have in that lead first or second, you know, chair. And, you know, as we see with the Warriors now, with all the injuries and Durant leaving and everything, it's amazing how fast that things can turn around and change. And to your point, I think that when you get somebody in the right situation, it's much more likely that they're going to develop and find their, you know, find their full potential. As you look back on sort of the last couple drafts, as you've been looking over things, were there guys that let's ask it two ways. So give me the name of a guy or two that you were pretty high on that maybe other people weren't as high on that turned out that you were correct. And then maybe somebody, conversely, somebody that you really liked that maybe hasn't had the type of success that you thought they were going to have heading into a draft. Is there guys that fit those two profiles?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for this year, obviously it's early, but you know, Rui Hachimura, myself and all my guys, we were really high on him the entire year. And he got drafted right in the range that we thought he would. I think it surprised a lot of people that he went that high. But he's doing really well. And so, I mean, I think we were spot on with him. I'm pulling up the mock draft or draft right now. See who would fit this. Two guys that we were high on all year that slip, and I think slip for things off, you know, off the court type stuff is Kevin Porter and Bol Bol. But both those guys slipped, but I don't think it was basketball related. And so we had them rated pretty highly, and they slipped pretty good. We were
all right. So I got two things there. So one, obviously Porter, we've seen him now, and he's, I mean, I don't know what exactly all his off court issues were or weren't, but the guy's a talent. He's been fun to watch. I think if he can straighten out whatever was, you know, whatever needs straightening out, I think he's going to be a really good player in the league for a long time. So we really, what we've seen so far in flashes with the Cavs, we really like him. And all during the draft, as the Cavs had their, you know, had their picks in the second round, those, you know, the other two number one picks, I wanted him to take Bol. I just thought that he was a guy who, I mean, he could be out of the league in 2 years because of injury concerns and, you know, all these other things. But I also thought that he was a guy who, if he figured it out and could stay healthy, that he could be a potential star. So talk to me about what you liked about Bol heading into the draft.
He's so skilled. You know, I mean, really can shoot the ball. His instincts, blocking shots and rebounding. And you had a sample size of him. I mean, he averaged like what, over 20 points, 12 rebounds, I think like three blocks or something like that. I just think he's a unique prospect. And, you know, I mean, there are some concerns with his personality and, you know, with the broken foot. I still, even with the concerns, I can't believe he slipped as far as he did.
Yeah, I couldn't either. I was stunned.
But, you know, and I knew there was some baggage there. So, I mean, him slipping wasn't a huge surprise. Him slipping that far was a big surprise. Same thing with Porter. I didn't think Porter would even get close to where, I mean, where they get him, like 30 or 31.
Yep. Uh-huh, yeah. Yep.
And, I mean, talent wise, I mean, that kid should have been a top 10 pick easy. And I mean, if, you know, if he's able to mature, like you said, I mean, that guy has star potential, and if it clicks, watch out. I mean, they just got to steal.
Yeah, I agree. What was your take on our, we'll might as well cover all the Cavs picks. What was your thoughts on Windler heading into the draft last year? He hasn't played because of injury yet, so we haven't seen much of him, but just give us your thoughts on where he was pre-draft.
Well, I mean, I think with Windler, you know what you're getting. I mean, he's got a clear-cut, translatable skill. He shoots the heck out of the ball. He's got good size, and he shoots it. But with the good, there's the bad. I mean, he can't defend anybody. And, I mean, I really think he's going to be a liability and then be on that end of the ball. But he could stretch it. And, I mean, I think with the way Beilein coaches, that you know, he found that to be valuable for what he's trying to build. And, you know, I think it was a high pick for him. But they got their guy, and they got, you know, obviously got a need they wanted to address.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm curious to see him get out on the floor and, you know, just watching him. I can't say that I was super familiar or watched him a lot in college, but obviously he could shoot it, and it'll be interesting to see if he can defend his position in the NBA at all, and that'll ultimately probably determine, you know, his ceiling and where he's at. Let's jump back to this year's draft. Give us a sleeper or two that maybe is going to go in the, you know, post-lottery, a post-lottery guy or two that you like that maybe people who are watching college basketball this year should keep an eye on.
Yeah, there's some freshmen that are kind of coming on the scene here hot. Onyeka Okongwu from USC, big body. He's like 6'9", 250, rebounder, kind of just a bully kind of guy. He's looking really good at USC. I think he'll be a one and done. I think he'll be a top 20 pick. He's looking good. Another Pac-12 guy, Zeke Nagy at Arizona. He's really coming around too. He's 6'11", just a well-rounded big guy. Shoot the ball, rebounder, plays hard. Those two guys are moving up. And then another kid I really like is the point guard at Memphis, Damian Ba. And he's still pretty under the radar. He's just a very athletic defender, just like a high motor point guard. Those three guys I'm watching pretty closely, and obviously being freshmen, they need to have good years to come out early and all that. But those are definitely names to watch.
All right, so talk a little bit about your process for how you go about creating your mock draft and what you personally are doing day to day to prepare for all the information and gathering all the information. Just talk about what you do day to day to put this mock draft together and to do what you do.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that's important to understand about our operation is that my partner Matt McKay, who's a former NBA scout, he works with me on Babcock Hoops. He and I also co-own Pro Insight, which is a scouting service that we sell to college teams. That's all for high school players. And so Matt really runs the scouting of the high school players. I overlap and do some, but long story short, the reason I'm telling you this is that we start early. So, I mean, we get really ahead on the high school players. So by the time they step on campus, we already know them. And so, right. It's not like, hey, we're putting together this mock draft because we watched one game on film. You know what I mean? This has been years of gathering information,
for sure.
kind of knowing their backgrounds, and knowing their talent. And now that they're playing and we have something else to kind of throw into the equation, it's just confirming our thoughts and whatnot. And so we've got a staff. So it's with Babcock Hoops, the staff is so it's myself, Matt McKay, who worked in the NBA for 8 years, Jason Felipe, who's based in Bologna, Italy. And he's got 20 years of NBA experience. At one point, he was director of international scouting for the Blazers. And then we've got Fran Fischilla, and several other guys that are part of our support staff. But sort of the protocol is I'm the decision maker on all the picks in the mock draft. So I tell all my guys, if anybody gives you a hard time about our mock draft, just blame it on me, because it's the truth. And awesome. So the way we're trying to do is we're simulating that we are like an NBA team. So with every pick, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of that GM and make picks based on the information I have. So it's, this early in the year, it's a little rough, but by the time we get to the draft time, it's looking pretty good.
So how many game films are you watching of, let's say the top 10, top 15 guys? Are you watching every game they play? How much are you watching of their film? Are you breaking it down with Synergy and pulling out, possessions and specific kinds of looks and how they, read the pick and roll and that kind of thing? Or how do you go about, watching and doing that versus how much are you looking at it in person?
It's definitely a balance. I travel pretty regularly going to games. I mean, being in person, seeing a guy is very important, especially if you don't know him at all. I mean, just kind of getting a feel for his body, his movements, his personality. I mean, just his, start to finish, tendencies start to finish. But then we watch a ton of film too. And so we have a partnership with a company called Instat. It's very similar to Synergy. And, when I'm home, I spend, hours watching film. So I'm watching at least breakdowns of all of these top prospects, just about every one of their games. And then I watch some full games too. I just kind of mix it up, and I like having a balance of a little bit of everything, really.
Understood. So if you look at what Babcock Hoops is today and you think about where you're going to go in the future, do you see yourself continuing to do what you're doing? Do you see yourself adding potential services, doing things tangentially related to what you already do? What's the future for Babcock Hoops in your mind?
Yeah, and I think we'll probably keep it pretty similar to where it's at now. I mean, we have had some conversations with some bigger media outlets about sort of merging what we're doing with their stuff. That's a possibility. I don't feel like the desperate need to do that. But we'd be have open ears on that if somebody gave us a good opportunity. But for me personally, I mean, working for an NBA team is probably something I'll look to do at some point. But I like what I'm doing. I mean, I've got Babcock Hoops, we got Pro Insight that's launching, and then I also have a consulting company where we pretty much consult with anybody within basketball. So I like what I'm doing. Business is going well. So if and when a good opportunity from an NBA team were to arise, I would surely take a look at it. But in the meantime, we're all enjoying what we're doing and just kind of keep chipping away at it.
It's nice to be your own boss, right?
Sure.
All right. So before we get out, why don't you give people an opportunity, let them know how they can get in touch with you, how they can find out more about what you're doing, share that contact information. And then if there's anything that we didn't hit on tonight that you want to share before we wrap up, go ahead and do that now. And then we'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Sure. Yeah. So BabcockHoops.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at Babcock Hoops. My personal account is MattBabcock11. Then for Pro Insight, it's PerspectiveInsight.com. Check out the websites.
Matt, we can't thank you enough for jumping out with us tonight and spending some time talking NBA draft and talking about just your own personal basketball journey and the process of how you went about creating your company and really getting it to the point where you're able to have the kind of success that you've had. So thanks for being a part of the Hoopheads podcast. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.